The following presentation was recorded at the 1999 Teachers Workshop at Faith Builders. More information on Faith Builders events at fbep.org.
Oh, good morning. This is a workshop, and I'd like to begin by giving you two statements that are incomplete, and looks like we're sitting fairly close together. I'd like to have you just turn and find two other people, and for about 90 seconds, brainstorm about what could complete that statement, both of those statements. Could you do that? Just turn to someone next to you, about groups of two or four, and try to complete those statements. Clock's rolling, okay? Okay, you're finished. Let's hear a few completions of the statement. Just call them out. Character is like a gift because... How's that?
Because it can teach.
Okay, it can teach. All right, someone else.
Because you can't create your own integrity. You just have to maintain what God gives you.
Okay, you can't create your own integrity. You have to maintain... Okay. So it's not something I can necessarily do on my own. Yes. Good. I like that. Someone else.
I can't create my own godly character. My godly character is something that God gives me.
Okay. Good.
As and if I take it.
As and if I take it. It's a process.
To the degree that I can build character in my life, it's usually a gift, something I've learned from someone else.
I like that. Good. Character is like a tree because...
It's on unseen roots that expresses itself.
I love that. Unseen roots that express themselves. Anyone else?
Branches are the cord inside the tree will not always be hidden from the leaf will fall on them.
Yeah, there's one organism that, like Jesus said, you can't have a bad tree and good fruit. You can have part of your character be good and part of your character be bad. But it's all interconnected.
It's excellent. Anyone else? Okay, those are excellent statements, and they get us to thinking about the essence or the nature of character. Now, let's complete these statements together. People don't care how much you know until they... All right, until they know how much you care. You cannot impart what you do not... Have, possess, okay? Good. And as a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. A couple of years ago, I sat in my office with a man discussing some issues in his life, and I had wanted to know more about his walk with God, his relationships, his friendships, his family, and he resisted. I shared with him the importance of his own personal growth and tried to articulate why it was important to talk about it. He listened in silence for some time, and then, perplexed and frustrated, he said, "Why do I need this? My students won't know that I don't have any friends. I will go in and teach and go home. They don't need to know about my personal life. I don't see why it's important that my personal life has certain qualities if I go in and teach." Well, this may sound a little harsh, but fortunately he's not teaching today. Because you see, character does matter. Who you are does matter. Your ability to manage the classroom is directly connected to who you are. No amount of technique will make up the difference. And then there are qualities of character and teacher that make all the difference. So we're going to look at those three areas this morning. We're going to look at why character matters. We're going to look at how character really does impact the classroom. And then we're going to look at some essential qualities. First of all, why is character so important to teaching? Daniel Taylor said that character is not something you have. It is something that inevitably shows itself in what you do. If we look at the origin of the word character, you'll find that it is the same word used to describe a tool used to make an imprint on a coin or a hard surface. It makes an imprint and leaves a mark. This happens in the doing. Because the tool is placed against the substance, it leaves an imprint. It's inevitable. It has to be that way. Character establishes my credibility. It's the credentials that I have when I walk in the classroom. In 1966, the term credibility gap was coined to describe what was happening between the younger generation and the older generation in the 60s. And it was a credibility gap because the younger generation felt they could no longer trust or believe the older generation. And so they set out to make their own values, their own beliefs, and they chucked the values and beliefs of their parents. We cannot afford to have that happen in our classrooms. We don't want a credibility gap. Someone else has said that reputation is what people think you are. Character is what God knows you are. I had a teacher in the first and second grade who made a lifelong impact on my life. She was an older single lady. Let me tell you what I remember about Miss Emsweiler. First of all, she loved God. I knew that because she was always talking about God and reading missionary stories. She told story after story about how God had done miraculous things in the life of some missionary and in the lives of people who served him with their whole life. As I grew older, I made sure I read some of those same books that she read to us. And if I heard that one of those speakers was going to be in the community, one of those missionaries she had talked about, I wanted to go hear them. I just admired them, never having met them, because I heard her talk about them. Secondly, she could apologize when she was wrong. I was walking in from recess one time, and she was nearby, and something had happened. I don't recall the incident, but I remember very clearly what she did. She came up and swatted me on the behind. She thought I was the one in the wrong. And, of course, I was caught by surprise, being a good little boy. And I was not in the wrong that time, I don't think. I wouldn't know anymore. I don't remember what happened. But I declared my innocence at that moment. And she apologized immediately. Now, again, I don't remember anything else about that, but I very distinctly remember her coming. I remember seeing that SWAT coming. And I remember the walk from that point on into the classroom. I could take you to the very spot. I just remember the lighting and the walls. And I remember the whole trip. And I remember that she apologized. And that made an imprint on my life. 6 or 7 years later, we were living in another community, and she came to visit our family. And she was on her way north to missions. And she needed a place to stay. The reason she needed a place was because she didn't have any money. And she didn't know how she was going to make it the rest of the way. She stayed at our home for probably close to a week. And while she was there, she made comments like, "If God wants me there, I'll get there." And I remember my parents kind of saying, "Well, shouldn't we be doing something?" And she was just there. Good morning, you know. Oh, it's time for breakfast. Very good. So we'll sit down and eat breakfast. And the whole week was that way. By the end of the week, she was on a plane on her way. That made an impression. During that same visit, it was very obvious that there was something physically wrong with her. She was in her 50s, older single lady, and it looked like she was 5 months pregnant. She had a tumor in her stomach, and she had refused treatment. And she had refused surgery. She said that God could take care of the tumor if he wanted to take care of it, But until then, she was perfectly comfortable to wait and see what happened. I remember very clearly her sitting in our living room, and as a 13, 14-year-old boy, kind of stealing a curious glance once in a while at her abdomen. And she seeing me do that and smiling, and without saying a word, saying, yeah, it's fine. It's going to be okay. It's no big deal. That made an impression. Several months later, we received the news of her death. She had fallen and injured her stomach and died. Miss Emsweiler also wrote a song. Some of you may know it, Tender Love of Jesus. So lovely and so pure, flowing through this vessel to strengthen, fill, and cure. All the doubt and turmoil that's caused by sin and shame, making me a witness to His most holy name. And the chorus goes, yes, love, the holy presence, Christ's love, the living flame, pure love, the Spirit's witness, great love that lauds His name. With joy my heart is singing, the things of life grow dim. For Christ, my dear Redeemer, is love. I am in Him. That's character. Not only is character important, but we're specifically looking this morning at how does character impact classroom management. Character inspires confidence, Howard Hendricks says, in those who listen. In fact, Socrates said it as well, that when a public speaker stands to persuade his audience, it's the character of the speaker that gives him credibility with his audience. They're willing to sit and listen. They're willing to hear. It inspires confidence. They can say, I trust you. And it's probably the greatest commodity we have going for us in communication and in the classroom. Character impacts classroom management because it has to do with me knowing what I'm talking about. I know what I'm talking about. When I want to establish procedure, when I want to maintain order, when I want to plan and articulate what the class is going to be about, I know what I'm talking about. It inspires confidence. I can be trusted. I'm qualified. I'm dependable. I'm trustworthy. It means I can carry out what I say I will do. If you taught very long and you worked with 10, 15, 25 students, you know how important it is to be able to carry out what you say you will do. You'll have many reminders if you don't. J. Oswald Sanders, in discussing leadership, describes spiritual leadership as having the following three characteristics. He says it's authoritative. It's authoritative. Thinking about inspiring confidence. Authoritative means that the person or the teacher knows where he or she is going and inspires confidence. It becomes authoritative. People are willing to follow and listen to someone who knows where they're going. In fact, they do it almost without thinking. When they realize that you know where you're going, what you have planned, they'll follow because it feels good. It inspires confidence. Secondly, spiritual leadership is sacrificial. It's sacrificial. Your leadership is modeled on the life of Jesus Christ, who sacrificed His life. And your leadership is sacrificial. And third, he said it's spiritual in that it cannot be completely explained in terms of the natural. I like that. It cannot be completely explained in terms of the natural. There's an element there that people say, you know, there's just something I can't quite figure out what he does or what she does that makes that so powerful. It cannot be explained in terms of the natural. It's more than a technique. A great example of this in Scripture is the man Nehemiah. I love the story. Nehemiah was a man who knew what it meant to put his life on the line. Every meal he was there to test the king's drink. He was a man of prayer. He fasted and prayed for a month before he did anything. He was a man of action. When he had his chance to speak before the king, he was ready. And when he got to Jerusalem, he didn't wait to convince people. He went out in the dark of night, surveyed the ruins, developed his plan, and presented it to the people. He faced incredible obstacles. You read the story. Amazing, the obstacles this man faced. Treachery, limited resources, convincing people the project was even possible, motivating them to work from, it says, from the time the sun came up until the stars were out at night. Try that on your students. They were working in constant threat of battle. He experienced people who were struggling with jealousy, other relational difficulties that he had to solve. Yet he was able to overcome all of these obstacles to accomplish his purpose and vision. And the people had confidence in him. They trusted him. He was there for over 12 years. If you read his memoirs, you will find periodically the phrase, "Remember me, O God, O my God, for all I have done for these people." You begin to get a picture of the loneliness he felt and the sacrifice it took for him to accomplish that. Never once did he demand public acclaim or special privilege. It says he did not take the money from the people to put the food on his table. It was sacrificial. He didn't take any special privileges. He stands as a tremendous example of spiritual leadership, authoritative, sacrificial, and spiritual. You read his story and you realize that you cannot completely describe what happened there in terms of the natural. It was an amazing feat. I believe that when we have this kind of leadership in our classrooms, people can entrust their futures. Students, children, young people can entrust their futures, their lives. They'll share it with you. They'll tell you how they're feeling. They'll entrust that to you. They will share with you their desires. Here's what I want to be. Here's what I'd like to do. But you need to be for real. Students are willing to receive your correction and input, because you really can deliver the goods, your character, who you are. You're not going to opt out of their life after some tight incident that was maybe embarrassing for them. You're going to stick with them. You're going to say good morning in the same old way the next day. You're not going to use them as stars in your own crown, tallies on your own sheet, but they know that you care about them. You will demonstrate that what you do is for them, it's not for you. That's how character impacts classroom management. I want to look now, thirdly, at essential character qualities. David makes a statement in Psalm 26. And let me just read that to you. He's speaking of his integrity. And that's the first quality I want to speak of this morning, integrity. I have seven of them to share with you. Psalm 26, verse 1. "Judge me, O Lord, for I have walked in mine integrity. I have trusted also in the Lord, therefore I shall not slide." Now, I don't know, I didn't do the research, I don't know if we know when David wrote this. I'm assuming it was earlier in his life. The NIV has that verse. It says, "Vindicate me, O Lord, for I have led a blameless life." A blameless life. But, you know, in my mind, I want to start saying, wait a minute, David, let me give you a list of words here. See, David, Bathsheba, Uriah, integrity. Which word doesn't fit? You know, I mean, it's... seems pretty obvious that something doesn't fit. And yet David says, "I have led a blameless life." So what is integrity? I think we think sometimes that if we have integrity, that means we never mess up. That means nobody can ever point the finger and say, you goofed. I can somehow live my life in a way that insulates me from the accusing finger. That's not integrity. Integrity does not equal perfection. It does not equal never failing, never making a mistake. It does equal being honest about my life. That's integrity. Being honest about my life. It means that who I am and what I appear to be matches. Who I am and what I appear to be matches. You know, in preparing for this, I was asking myself, what is it about integrity that makes us respond so deeply to someone who demonstrates it? Why is it so central to healthy relationships? Is it just, you know, is it some mechanism God's put in place? I don't know that I can completely answer the question, except I did think of this. Integrity flies at the heart of any kind of deception. Isn't deception, by definition, making things look one way and they're something else? And if I put you in a completely dark room and you had no clue, you didn't know if I really cared about your physical safety or not. You weren't sure. You didn't know me and you weren't sure that I cared about your physical safety. I put you in a completely dark room and I say, go ahead and walk to the other side. You've never been in the room before. You've never seen it and lighted up. You have no idea if there's a stairway somewhere in the room, if there are sharp objects. You don't know. So you start off. And you feel your way around the room. How much do you accomplish? Very little. And then you bump into a sharp object. You nearly fall down the stair. And suddenly, you're almost frozen. You can do nothing because you have no idea. Is there going to be a cliff there, you know, stairway? What's going to happen next? And so you almost aren't able to move. You might get down your hands and knees and begin to feel around to try to get through the room. Integrity means that none of that is true in the relationship. That I can look at you and predict the response. I'm not surprised. What you see is what you get. When a student sees integrity, trust becomes a fundamental in the relationship. They can trust. They don't have to be locked up, frozen. They can reach out and take risks. They can begin to take a few tentative steps toward real change. One of the words that captures this idea of integrity is the idea of no veneer. And that's what I understand the Hebrew word really means. There's no veneer. That when I scratch the surface, I see the same thing underneath. I can take a nail and gouge in that nice, smooth, shiny surface, and I don't get to the cheap particle board, you know, that flakes and falls apart in cheap furniture. No veneer. There's wholeness. There's honesty. There's uprightness. As I said earlier, it doesn't mean that I can tell a student, look, I've kept all the rules, and therefore I can demand the same from you. It's not that approach at all. A friend of mine was driving down the highway, and there were two of them traveling together with their families, and the man behind him, they didn't know each other all that well, and the man behind him was following, and my friend is a very conscientious person about the speed limit, and he tries to keep the speed limit, but he happened to be driving, a few miles per hour over. It wasn't, I don't know that he's even 5 miles per hour over. And the man behind him afterwards asked him, he says, now I noticed you were going over the speed limit. And he said, oh, was I? So I didn't think I wasn't watching. He said, well, yeah, you were doing more than the speed limit. And so my friend said, well, I appreciate you saying something. I try to watch that. I don't make a practice of driving over the speed limit. He said, well, that's good. He says, just don't let your children see you go over the speed limit. Okay, do you see the attitude that's coming through there? It's like if If he expects anything out of his children, he's got to be perfect. Don't let your children see you go to the speed limit. What lever do you have then to demand their obedience? That is not where his authority rests as a dad in the life of his children or in your life as a teacher. At some point, that issue could be a problem. But it's not in the sense that it has to be perfect, that they can never see him make a mistake. Okay, that is not the basis of his integrity. That is more what the Pharisees did to the people. They tried to project a perfect, righteous image, and then they tried to demand the people. And Jesus said, you place burdens on them that I can't remember the verse exactly, but that the idea was they can't bear, that no one was created to bear. It's arrogance and self-righteousness. That's not integrity. Integrity reflects God's holiness, which is the perfection we're looking for, but it also reflects God's grace. Because none of us can do well enough to be perfect. It does not mean that I never fail or fall. It does mean that I deal honestly, that I am honest. When I fail, when I'm caught in a failure, I say, yes, you're right. I'm sorry. I was wrong. And I believe that is why David could declare his integrity before God. He knew that when he failed, he could repent. That's the answer. That's the answer, repentance. I'm always struck by this verse at the end of David's reign when he's speaking to Solomon and he's praying and turning the kingdom over to Solomon. And they've just dedicated things to the temple. And he's telling God, he's praising God for all these things the people gave toward this building of the temple. And Solomon has already been anointed king. And David says, O Lord our God, as for all this abundance that we have provided for building you a temple, it comes from your hand. All of it belongs to you. I know, my God, that you test the heart and are pleased with integrity. King James calls it uprightness. David says, I know, God, that you test the heart and are pleased with integrity. I love to think of the context here. He numbered the people against better knowledge and rebuke. He had an affair. He failed. He lied. He murdered a man in deception. I know, God, that you test the heart and are pleased with integrity. It's an incredible testimony. Second quality that I think needs to be developed in our lives is the quality of discipline. And this is not a pleasant one. As I studied and reflected on this, I squirmed in my chair many times. Discipline. This is your ability to persevere in the unpleasant task. It's your ability to persevere when no one's looking. Persevere when it's grunge work. You know, things like sweeping your classroom at the end of the day, mopping the floor. The list is endless. You know what I mean. Preparing, going the extra mile and preparing the lesson, going the extra mile and responding to those essays that have been written and giving the feedback you know the student really needs to be encouraged and motivated to keep writing and trying. It's doing the responsible thing when I could be enjoying leisure. You know, I could logically, rationally, reasonably say, oh, this is okay, there's nothing wrong with doing this. But it's choosing instead the high ground. It's doing the absolute best thing instead of doing what would be okay. The important thing about this quality is that the rest of your character will never realize its full potential if you haven't done some hard work on this one. I remember when I was 16, I often tell this story that I was working in the summer for a large factory. They had, I don't know, some like 30-some plants, buildings. And my job that summer, along with two other high school students, was to walk around 3 to 4 days a week picking up trash and hand-chopping weeds. Okay? This is all day long, 8 hours. And when you're 16, 8 hours is a long time. And we would start at 6:30 in the morning, and we'd get off at 3. And, you know, my wife and I have had a long-standing joke. We have ever since then. Whenever I drive past that place, we always it's on a main road. And whenever I drive past, I used to chop weeds around that building. I picked up a lot of trash over there. Well, it seemed like every time that you stop for a deserved rest, you stop for a moment, the boss drives by. Great. Hey, I work hard the rest of the time. Trust me, And so, discipline, though, is keeping on, doing it when you just don't feel like it, when it's the last thing you feel like doing. How many days we crawled in the back of that pickup truck and drove over to the next plant, hauled ourselves out of the back, started chopping weeds, picking up trash, walking past the guys in the plant who were making the big bucks, who had the nice jobs, the real jobs, the respectable jobs. Discipline. Amy Carmichael writes, "God hardened me against myself. The coward with pathetic voice who craves for ease and rest and joy. Against myself, arch traitor to myself, my hollowest friend, my deadliest foe, my clog, whatever road I go." Isn't that true? You will never lead people beyond your own level of discipline. I've come up against that time and time again. I will never lead people beyond my own level of discipline. Third essential quality in character, I believe, is courage. Courage. Joseph is a tremendous example of this area of courage. Think about him as a man who experienced heartache. He caught the brunt of envy and jealousy and malice and deceit. Every one of those evils that are so terrible on how we are able to view life with courage and hope. Yet Joseph experienced all of those, spent days and years in the dungeon. Days of being alone, experiencing heartache, disappointment. I'm sure he spent many a day wondering if he was going to spend the rest of his life in this dungeon. And yet he persevered. He had courage. Not only did he have courage, but the fourth essential quality is vision. Vision. Do you have a vision for your students? As I thought about vision, what is my vision for my students? What is it that carries me? Someone has said that vision is not only foresight, it's insight. It's not only foresight, but it's insight. Often we think, well, I don't have vision. I'm not able to see down the road like some people. I can't look down the road and say, if we're going to be ready for 2 years from now, we need to start doing this. I know a lot of us probably don't feel very able to do that. But that's foresight. But vision is not only foresight, it is insight as well. What is your vision for your student? When you look at those students, what do you see? What do you see as being important or necessary for them to develop and become what God wants them to become? Let me share with you four things that I see. One of the things I see is that they need, more than anything else, a relationship with Jesus Christ. Now, I teach high school, and so I'm able to do that more directly, perhaps, than some of the elementary teachers. However, I believe it's true, nonetheless, that I know that more than anything else, they need a relationship with Jesus Christ if they're going to become anything in life. If they're going to be able to overcome the heartaches, disappointments, the obstacles of life, they need a relationship with Jesus Christ. Secondly, and I'm trying to find the paper I had this written on. I can't find it. I know I had it. I think I can recall them. Secondly, I know that who I am, that's what I'm talking about today, I know that who I am matters more than how much I know or than how much they know. Who I am matters more. That's part of my vision. A third part of my vision then is, if I can remember this, I am stuck. I don't remember that. Okay, I may have to come back to that. Let's move on to the fifth category. Fifth category is compassion. If I can think of those items of vision, I'll come back to that. Compassion. Why do people respond so deeply to compassion? What is it about a caring, compassionate person that sparks in a student a desire to know that person? Going back to the model that I mentioned that Socrates had in a public speaker, he said that a speaker's compassion produces motivation in the student. And you know, in classroom management, motivation is fundamental to getting anything done for the student. People are just instinctively drawn to people who love them. I'll never forget being surprised. First day I entered a classroom in the new school, and it was only 2 or 3 days later, someone commented to me that, you know, the students came home. I talked to the students the second or third day of school, and they said, you know, we think we're going to like the new teacher. He cares. He cares. Now, I knew that I cared. What surprised me was that they knew that I cared. In 2 days of school, I mean, you know, I didn't even have them for all day long. I just had them for a couple classes. But they knew, and they commented on it. They didn't just kind of, it wasn't just a passing thought. When they were asked about school and the new teacher, they said, he cares. Now, what is it in us that responds so quickly to someone who cares? Well, I think people want to be cared for. People want to grow and develop. They want input that helps them get somewhere. Don't all of us have a sense that, yes, I'm here, but I'm not completely content. I'd like to move that direction. And when someone cares about me, what do I feel? Hope. There's hope. And maybe I can move a little bit. Maybe I can go that way since this person cares. Aren't we all used to insulating ourselves from people that hurt us? We're used to insulating and protecting ourselves because we don't want to be hurt. We're kind of used to people, most people, not truly caring, aren't we? We move through a crowd. We don't expect loving gestures moving through a crowd. We kind of move through in a way. If I meet you on the sidewalk and I don't know you, it's sociology is interesting. You know, they've talked about the fact that when we meet on the sidewalk, we don't turn toward each other to pass on the sidewalk. What do? We move this way. We both, you know. It's kind of protective. We just naturally do that. We don't open ourselves to a stranger. It's not safe. We don't know this person. So we're used to protecting ourselves. So when someone gives, aren't we surprised? We're a little amazed. We're blessed. We say, yes, this person cares. The act of caring, I believe, offers life. Selfishness is the opposite of compassion. It's about me. It's not about you. And so it's a sign of life within when I can care for other people. Students respond to someone, or for a student to respond to someone who uses them, who may forget them, or who may embarrass or humiliate them in front of their peers, is only to invite more pain. Why should they respond some more? But when they know I care and I reach out, they're going to respond. Sixth quality is humility. Humility. Peter says, humble yourselves in the sight of God, and he will lift you up. He will lift you up. Humble yourselves. It's always striking to me that he doesn't say, allow God to humble you. He says, humble yourself. Get an accurate view of yourself. I don't think it's possible to be humble, at least for me, it's not possible to be humble unless I know that I'm serving someone greater. I'm in a cause greater than myself. And I begin to see again and again that it's not about me, it's about Him. It's about the cause. It's about that person, God, Jesus Christ. It's not about me. And I begin to see that God can get things done without me sometimes, when I'd like to think that He needs me to get this done. But He can get it done without me. Humility. A humble man is consumed with a higher calling. Teacher has the students' welfare on their minds, not their own welfare. And therefore, when you do that, you're not making decisions based on how it makes you look, how it makes you feel. None of that. You're making decisions based on what it does for your students. Without humility, you cannot do that, because pride is consumed with self. Someone has said that humility enables you to resist despair. And that grabbed my attention, because I thought, what is it about humility that protects me from despair? How often have you been in despair in a situation? After a tough day in the classroom, I would imagine if you've taught very long, you've had 3 o'clock moments of despair. What is it about humility that protects me from despair? Again, despair often comes when I'm feeling very, very inadequate and incompetent and just unable to do what needs to be done. Why can't I pull this off? And humility again says, I can't. Not by myself. I cannot do it. If I know, again, that it's not so much about me, even though we're talking about character here, but it's more about what God wants done than it is about what I want done. And I'm serving a higher purpose, a higher calling. It takes the weight off of me. It really does. And I don't have to explore all the dirty corners of despair when I know that it's not so much about me. It's about the student. It's about what God's doing, and I can have a part in it, but the whole weight is not on me. Humility also means that I can follow another person's leadership. We've heard this. You have to learn to follow. It's like the boys out playing on the street, and they're playing war. And someone was watching, and they noticed that the war came to a standstill pretty quick. And they asked them, what's the problem? They said, well, we're all generals, and nobody wants to fight. Okay? Well, that's a little bit the way it is sometimes. If we want to be a general, and we have never experienced what it's like to be a soldier, there's going to be a problem. Because to be a soldier means to put your life on the line for somebody else. It's to do the thing that needs to be done, but there's no individual glory or prestige. You're behind the scenes. You're making someone else look good. I mean, Eisenhower. We all know Eisenhower, don't we? Dwight D. Eisenhower, commander of the Allied forces. How many gritty soldiers fought in World War II? We don't know their names. But we know Eisenhower. Does that mean he did the most important thing in the war? Well, yes and no. Humility. How to be a follower. Number 7, the quality that we need is transparency. Transparency. I didn't know quite what to call this. I thought about calling it relationship. I thought about calling it friendship. Perhaps transparency is a word that encapsulates some of the things that I was thinking here. Primarily, what I mean by transparency is that you have a few significant relationships in your life, that there are a few people who really know you well. What is significant about that? Again, a few examples. I think of Nehemiah, who, when he was told by a so-called friend, why don't you go to the temple and shut the doors, because people are out after, they're out seeking your life. Okay, why don't you go to the temple and take refuge in there? Nehemiah had the foresight to know. He says, look, if I do that, my reputation is going to be damaged, because people know that you're not supposed to do that. And so in order to save my skin, I'm going to do that. Now, That's transparency because he opened his life to the people. He was not afraid. He's resting in God. Another example. When you open your life to people, you begin to live differently because you know that you can no longer seem to be something. There are people who know who you are, who you be, as a friend of mine said. They know who you be, not just who you seem. And so when I begin to live in that reality, I find myself doing this time and again. You know, I can be gracious and loving and respond quite well to students, even under a fair amount of pressure. But I can go home and the pressure's off. I can walk in the door and if I'm irritated, I'm willing to kind of let it show. I'm willing to brush somebody off. I'm willing to say, not now, ask me later. I'm willing to do those things. And nothing will happen in my teaching. I will make no progress in my teaching. In fact, I think you are at the beginning of the end if you do not begin to address what happens when you walk in the door at home and that situation occurs. Your family, the thing about your family is they know you. They know who you be. But they'll often cover for a long time. For a long time. Nobody else knows. And if there's no one else in your life that knows, you can continue to seem instead of be. And so transparency is so important. Important thing to remember about this quality of transparency is that it will not transform your teaching overnight. It will not transform your teaching overnight. This will take years. And this is why you ought to consider staying in teaching for 20 years instead of one or two or three. Because this will begin to develop in your life more and more. How many of us haven't met an older man or woman who has lived a transparent life? And we see the results. There is a rest in them. They're so comfortable. They're safe. And we want to spend time with them. Now, in your first year of teaching, you can probably communicate some of those qualities. In fact, you can even take an active listening course from someone who's not even a Christian. Take an active listening course and study communication and figure out the body language you need to invite people to share with you. You can figure out the words to use to reflect so that it invites more. You can find out how to look in your face, not too intense, but not too laid back. And you can practice and hone those skills all you want. But if in the core, it will not. If in the core you do not have this quality of transparency, sooner or later someone will say, "Ah, he plays games. She plays games. She's just doing that. Yeah, she looks good in front of the classroom, but she's not for real." We know that. We know that. And there again, no amount of technique will make up for character. It will not make up. Now, does technique enhance character? It certainly does. There's some incredibly valuable things about learning how to listen and how to communicate. It can be a lifelong study. But at the core, there must be character. Character, then, is something you have. It's not something, I'm sorry, that you have. It is something that inevitably shows itself in what you do. We said that character inspires confidence and trust. We said that classroom management grows out of purpose and vision that you have for your students. It's an expression of who you are. Recently, I was home for a weekend, and we were giving some choral programs, and I was standing in the front of the church after the last program, talking to people, and the auditorium was nearly empty when a former student came up to talk to me, and we talked. We had a good time talking. "Hey, how you doing? It's good to see you. You know, how's things going?" And he was telling me about he just got married not that long ago, and he was telling me about how that was going and telling me how he was involved in his church and what he was doing, taking some leadership in his church. And we had a very nice chat. And it was good to talk to him again. And I was just amazed again at how much he was growing and developing as a person. The ironic thing about it was, is that he was the first student I had expelled. And I had agonized and sweated over this guy, I don't know how much. And he came up and talked to me. I got a note just last week from his mom who said, you know, I just thought it was so neat that he had already left the church and was 4 miles away when he remembered that I didn't talk to Brandon. He turned around and drove back, came up and talked to me. That means an incredible amount to me. Now, you'd think that that makes me look pretty good. But see, if you'd have seen me in the situation with the student, you'd have said, well, you know, you didn't communicate with the parent, the procedure, like you should have. If you'd have communicated with the parent more, you maybe could have avoided some things. If you would have been more sacrificial in your leadership, you may have been more redemptive in the life of that student. You could have seen a number of things that I had done, and I'd like, in one sense, I don't want to relive the experience, but in one sense, I'd like to go back and do it over knowing what I know now. You know that feeling? The point is that God had given me integrity then. You see, again, integrity and character is not about perfection. It's not about being perfect. It's about being real. And you can make a lot of mistakes. The most comforting thing about working with people in the classroom, to me, is that I can make a lot of mistakes. But if I'm for real, if I have integrity, students will overlook a great deal. This student knew I had honestly cared about him, and it made a difference. God wants to do the same thing through you.
Thank you, Melvin, and thank you, Brandon. You know, I was thinking that you can do a lot of things wrong, but if you do several things right, it may turn out okay. And one of them is to say, I'm sorry. What did I do that didn't feel good? What did I do that wasn't right? And then listen. Listen carefully and don't defend yourself. Is that right? Yeah. Okay. What I'd like to do is have a stand. We'll sing a song. And then we'll take your questions. And the questions will be, I think, directed toward Melvin and Brandon. But we will give you opportunity to ask a few questions.
For the most current Faith Builders recordings, visit ChristianLearning.org. And for more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit the DocForLearning.org.